While I entirely agree with Amber that integrity is too important a subject to be left only to philosophers, there are some philosophers who can illuminate the question. We have put most of them on this morning with a sort of foundational thought, and in the afternoon we will come more to people from practice. Let me welcome once again to... because he's friend of the house, Dieter Thome, professor of philosophy at the University of St. Gallen.
Thanks, Susan, for making me part of that joint endeavor. I hope this connects very well to the previous talk. Some remarks on varieties of integrity. Three sections will follow, titled Wandering Astray on a Path of Your Own, The Charm of a Rotting Soul, and Noble Depravity. So let me start with some general observations. We are inclined to plainly eulogize integrity. A person of integrity is expected to abhor loud-mouthed, narrow-minded dogmatism. We gladly acknowledge that she is up against fundamentalism. But we are well advised to take a step back. A switch from English to French curbs our enthusiasm. When we translate fundamentalism into French, the default result won't be fundamentalisme, but intégrisme. After 9/11, the cover of the French weekly Le Nouvel Observateur read, non au intégrisme. This semantic coincidence of opposites, a person of integrity fighting integrism, if this word existed in English, makes you look at integrity and look again. Why is it that there is this awkward vicinity between integrity and antigrisme? How can we do justice to the independent stance of integrity and its standing up against this very integrism? In order to live up to the promise of integrity, we should be cautious when celebrating it. That is, we should celebrate indeed, but we should celebrate the right kind of integrity so that it can be properly summoned up against fundamentalism. Today's rhetoric of integration appeals to an all-encompassing spirit of reconciliation and coherence. Today's rhetoric of integrity appeals to an impeccable record of soundness and sustainability. Yet the theory of integration and integrity is to proceed in a more critical mode. Etymologically and semantically speaking, integrity is a term, we have heard that, with a built-in negation. A person of integrity is intact, intangible or untouched. In this respect, the closest relative to integrity would be, again, innocence. If integrity literally means being untouched, innocence literally means being undamaged, unharmed. The theory of integrity has to account for the fact that it brings about demarcations, distinctions, and oppositions. Even though this does not really come to the fore in current debates, integrity is polemical in nature. It is bound to boundaries, to a shield protecting the pure from being tainted or contaminated. This distinctive, contrastive meaning comes with moral implications. We do not need to know of any particular merits or achievements of the person concerned, yet we presuppose that the threat from without aims at disturbing, corrupting, or destroying some quality that deserves protection. This can be a person's purity, soundness, wholeness, etc. Insofar, the claim made about a person of integrity equals the claim made about an innocent person. In the latter case, we insist on the fact that she hasn't done anything or that nothing should be done to her. This is telling. An innocent person doesn't need to excel in honorable deeds. She qualifies for innocence by the very absence of deeds. We may not be used to see it that way, but integrity can function, a minimal notion of integrity can function in a similar manner. This is evident in the high-ranking legal claim that the integrity of a person, right, be not be violated. To be sure, this human right also applies to subjects who we may find despicable. The semantics of integrity is about defending a person in a given state against any kind of violations, intrusions, or compromising offers. A person taking up the task of self-defense herself, this is a much more elevated version of integrity, insists on being intangible no matter what. Heinrich von Kleist's heroines, the Marquise von O or Käthchen von Heilbronn, excel in this capacity. You may call it assertiveness or obstinacy. Also, this guy not deliberating the idea of playing for Nero seems to fall in the same category. I readily concede that this particular reading of integrity does not fully coincide with the way this term is most commonly used in the political and moral debates of the day. In these debates, we do imply to know more about the mindset of a person of integrity. We do not just presuppose her worthiness or her deserving protection. I guess a good proxy, not a very good, but a good proxy for this most popular, widely acknowledged feature of integrity is consistency. In this vein, we praise a person's integrity when she is straightforward, outspoken, reliable, when she acts based on firm convictions, when she does not say X and thinks Y, when her actions today are consistent with her past behavior. As this kind of consistency is about internal coherence, it encompasses sincerity or honesty. You may wonder why integrity, which has its semantic basis in the purely negative, polemical stance of intactness, has been altered and adopted in such a way that it has come to apply to strong self-determined characters. In order to figure that out, we should for once consider mathematics. Integrity as consistency shares crucial features with integrality and the mathematical notion of an integral. You may feel that this reference is far-fetched, but you will see in a minute that it actually makes, hopefully, a lot of sense. As you may remember from high school, an integral stands for the content of an area defined by a line or curve. A mathematical integral captures an area completely, exhaustively. In order to successfully define an area, it has to have a border or boundary. Thus, the notion of boundary or demarcation, known from integrity as intactness, stays in play. Yet by turning to the area within, we change perspectives. It could be said that the external polemical notion of integrity stressing its discriminating force is complemented by an internal harmonizing notion of integrity embracing the fullness of the space within. I take these two variants to be the two central conceptions of integrity offered by the tradition. Whenever you are able to properly stake off an area or to mark a claim, you are enabled and entitled to map and to measure it in its integrity. What you find within the lines when getting acquainted with a person of integrity is not chaos or confusion, but coherence. Coverage is complete, there's no loophole, no catch, no dirty little secret. A person disposing of her internal world dispels the unsettling suspicion uttered by John Donne in his Anatomy of the World from 1611, that all coherence be gone. The two variants of integrity, intactness and consistency, hint at its adherence to a boundary not to be violated on the one hand, and to the wholeness or consistency of what is defined by such boundary on the other hand. These two features can be arranged in a sequence and bring about a change of perspectives. First, integrity is about remaining intact by defending a boundary. Secondly, it is about comprehending what this self is all about within its boundaries. The second feature builds on the first. We come to appreciate integrity as consistency only of the if the benignancy of the person concerned is warranted. This is where the first feature of integrity comes into play. There should be something inherently valuable about the person whose integrity we acknowledge. Internal consistency or integrity is a nice thing to have, but it should not be that of a villain. So far, I have been talking about personal integrity, yet we may be tempted to shift the limits and expand the integrated area where everything connects. If this area or room gets bigger and bigger, integrity is bound to become a trademark of the society at large, a framework in which integration is complete. In a different vocabulary, you could say that such a holistic social entity exerts immunity to the exterior sphere and is qualified by community within. It is tempting to fully embrace this social notion of integration, yet let's not overstate its potential. The more we push the limits of the space where everything is expected to fit together smoothly, the easier we forget about the fact that it has some edge to it. It is still defined by boundaries. Negotiations about inclusion and exclusion continue. When in turn we lose sight of those boundaries and settle down in the middle of an integrated society, we may appreciate embeddedness and get along with other well-integrated people, yet we may also vary about assimilation and homogeneity. We are not fond of bowling alone, Robert Putnam's nightmarish vision about the lack of social capital, yet we do not want to turn the whole world into a bowling center either. Imagine a multiplication of identities, and the world begins to look like a less dangerous place, a famous phrase by Michael Walzer. It is the social setting of a fully integrated society that gives us the opportunity to reconsider the uncanny vicinity between integrity and integrism. If integration is complete, a society enforces an order without friction and fissures. Internal deviations are banned, external boundaries become fortifications. This is what characterizes an integrist or fully integrated society, fundamentalist society. There's a marvelous line from John Stuart Mill taking issue with this notion. Quote, "No society in which eccentricity is a matter of reproach can be in a wholesome state." Now, Mill seems to fall prey to a paradox here. The wholesome state is combined with the approval of differences. This derangement subverts and contradicts wholeness, or doesn't it? At second glance, Mill's pairing is anything but paradoxical. As a matter of fact, a whole does not live up to the requirements of holism if it comes with exclusions. A whole that excludes something is defective or flawed. True totality has to embrace eccentricity. It contains multitudes, or it isn't any. Walt Whitman's line, "I contain multitudes," applies to individual and collective identities alike. We have learned at the beginning that inscribed in integrity is a defensive, polemical gesture, this negation. In order to maintain our intactness, in order to protect integrity, we fight afflictions and withstand pressure. We tend to lose sight of this hardship, of this cumbersome, vulnerable beginning of integrity when we boost the person of integrity as a sovereign figure excelling in good-natured reliability. Jean-Jacques Rousseau once coined the term frail existence, the fragile existence of the human being. It is this fragility that deserves protection in the name of integrity. Integrism has no use for fragility. One thing should have become clear by now. I'm well aware of the fact that consistency, firm convictions, and accountability make up the character displaying integrity. But I'm more interested in the widely neglected opening scene of the success story of integrity, the scene of resistance and self-defense. By going back to this scene, we can explain why the narrative of personal integrity comprises a large number of situations marked by a state of marginality or exception. A person of integrity defends her fragile existence. She remains true to herself. She sticks to her essentials. She does not give in for the sake of social recognition or affiliation. To put it bluntly, this person defends her integrity against integration, an integration that she regards as corruption. She feels that she needs to draw a line between her and the rest of the world. She may even agree with Ralph Waldo Emerson's famous verdict, society is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. Now, maintaining this integrity is a difficult task. A person defending her integrity as intactness does so under pressure. She faces afflictions. She does not have a firm stand nor a safe haven. It would be asking too much if we expected this person to have steadily, prudently focused on the task of building a character, of forming a flawless, consistent self-identity. My point is that there is a tension between the two types of integrity I have been talking about so far. Integrity as intactness is linked to a contested stance, to a person facing an imminent challenge and struggling for self-assertion. Integrity as consistency requires some stamina. It is linked to the labor of self-discovery and self-fashioning, of sorting out volitions and establishing wholeheartedness, to use Harry Frankfurt's terms. A person fighting for integrity as intactness is not in a state of repose in which she could work on her self-formation. Such a person cannot help but to fall short of the ideal of personal development and self-improvement put forward most forcefully by Johann von Wolfgang von Goethe. According to Goethe, I quote from Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, self-formation is based on the intention to develop myself fully, myself as I am. Self-formation is a process aiming at integrity as consistency. But this is a long shot for a person desperately seeking integrity as intactness. Let's have a closer look at Goethe in order to further elucidate the interplay between the two types of integrity. Second section, wandering astray on a path of your own. The reference to Goethe's novel is to the point, as this novel, Wilhelm Meister, not only tells the story of self-formation and consistency, it also presents a counter-image, famously, to this process. This counter-image has a name. It is Mignon, the mysterious girl acting with the assuredness of a sleepwalker. Wilhelm explained to her, this is Goethe talking, that she was now fully grown and something should be done for her further education. Response by Mignon, I'm educated enough to love and sorrow. Mignon may be too much of a fairy tale figure in order to properly play out the assertiveness required for integrity as intactness, but with her limited means, she defends immunity, resists manipulation, and also resists formation in this sense of integrity as consistency. So this self-formation can be costly. It has been argued that Goethe's novel is about adaptation and conformity to the world eventually. Goethe says about Wilhelm or the human being in general, quote, when his development has reached a certain stage, it is advantageous for him to lose himself in a larger whole, learn to live for others, and forget himself in dutiful activity for others. Only then will he come to know himself, end of quote. A striking passage from Hegel's Aesthetics comes to mind. I love this passage. Quote, the thing is to breach this order of things, to change the world, to improve it. But in the modern world, these fights are nothing more than apprenticeship, the education of the individual into the realities of the present. For the end of such apprenticeship consists in this, that the subject sows his wild oats, stößt sich die Hörner ab. In German, builds himself, it has this sexual undertone in English,
and in German as well, builds himself with his wishes and opinions into harmony with subsisting relationships and their rationality enters the concatenation of the world, end of quote. It is fair to say, though, that Goethe is at least conscious of the downside of development as formation. This consciousness comes to the fore in the Mignon figure, as well as at some other occasions. Thus, the Abbé says at one point, this figure in the novel, quote, a child or young person who goes astray on his chosen path is, in my opinion, preferable to many of those who pursue uncongenial paths. This modern English translation is actually rather weak. I looked up Thomas Carlyle's translation, and he says, who is wandering astray on a path of his own should be preferable to those who are walking aright upon paths which are not theirs. As it turns out, bad behavior can even be life-saving. Wilhelm's son, Felix, who was supposed to drink from a glass that, due to a tragic coincidence, nobody intended it, contained a deadly poison, was fortunately disobedient. He grabbed the bottle next to the glass instead and survived. Now, the comment, quote, his naughtiness has saved him. And in German, it's even better, die Unart hat ihn gerettet. Unart, this is one of those German words that are hard to translate. We will have some other encounters, by the way, with the art, the German art, type, kind, or manner, however you may translate it, in a minute. Wilhelm's son behaves badly. He is ill-mannered or unmannered. He moves, to use Goethe's phrase just quoted, on a path of his own, and for once this turns out to be a good thing. We turn to representatives of integrity as intactness when we feel that the mainstream is harmful and hostile to life. That is, when we are tempted to quote Walter Benjamin, that things go on and on is the catastrophe. This catastrophe does not need to come with thunderbolts. It can be rather inconspicuous. A person of integrity as intactness defends her state of mind against the destructive tyranny of one and the corrupting tyranny of many, against thoughtless normality, so-called common wisdom and common sense. This person's soundness cannot be taken for granted. Her vantage point may be called a vanguard point. I don't know whether this works in English, but she may also live beyond her means and overplay her hand. This is why such a person can appear as a saint as well as a madman, as an uncompromised spokesperson of a good, of the good, as well as a self-indulgent zealot. In Wilhelm Meister's apprenticeship, the dismissal of the marginalized maverick prevails. Quote, if I had not striven to extend my mind outward from myself into wider vistas, I would have become a very constricted and thoroughly insufferable person, for nothing is more unbearable than isolation and idiosyncrasy. End of quote. The opposition introduced in this phrase by Goethe, wider vistas versus isolation and idiosyncrasy, gets a more philosophical twist when we stick to the German. Here we learn about an opposition between the Weite und Allgemeine, vastness and universality, on the one hand, and abgeschnittene Eigenheit, on the other hand, which roughly translates as something like peculiarity cut loose. If we frame the relation between the status quo and the outsider in such a way, we end up with the familiar distinction between the universal or general on the one hand, the individual or particular on the other hand, and we suspect that the particular is peculiar, eccentric, strange, slightly weird. We are called upon to dispel this suspicion if we want to restore the credentials of the polemical figure representing integrity as intactness. But how could we do that? And to what extent is it possible at all? To be sure, there are people whose convictions are grounded in an unshatterable moral fundament. Yet playing the role of saviors from without is maybe asking too much from those who desperately defend their integrity as intactness and haven't managed to forge their weatherproof consistency. Yet, under severe conditions, bold claims about infallible moral judgments are daring. At this point, it makes good sense to return to Goethe's above-mentioned opposition between the particular or peculiar on the one hand, the Eigenheit, and the universal on the other hand. What if we subverted this opposition? Defending one's integrity becomes a moral task if a person overcomes particularity. If her individual validity claims transcend peculiar fancy, thereby testing and questioning the allegedly universal grounding of the status quo. In the course of this subversion, an existing order is required to put herself to the test, or otherwise is deemed to deteriorate to a merely conventional framework, to a prison of prejudice. In this perspective, a person under pressure challenging an order does not need to have a flawless moral record. She is to be taken seriously anyway, as she pushes the society to scrutinize its moral standards. Let us have a closer look at this threshold between this individual and the status quo, as it were. Let me look at a particular threshold in order to figure out the moral function of the marginal figure that, in my view, exerts integrity as intactness. Please meet Rameau's nephew, the charm of a rotting soul. Now, Rameau's nephew is the main character, as you know, of a novel written by Diderot in around 1770. It was not published during his lifetime. The manuscript ended up at St. Catherine the Great's court in Petersburg, was found there, sent to Germany, and was published in German for the first time, not in French, in 1805. The translator you all know, it's Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. The novel is structured as a dialogue between a moi and a lui, between myself and he. Diderot depicts the extensive negotiations between two figures impersonating different life forms. As you will see, they may be taken as representatives of integrity as consistency on the one hand, integrity as intactness on the other hand. By bringing a me into play, Diderot seems to play out his actorial authority and to invite us to take sides with him or with the me. We are lured into the conclusion that the me, the author's voice, should prevail over his interlocutor. Goethe, the translator, succumbs to this suggestion and emphasizes in the notes accompanying his translation that Diderot denounced the wickedness of the flatterer and the parasite. A scoundrel, Goethe says, is confronted with an honest man. It does not come as a surprise that Goethe is suspicious of the nephew and picks the me as the winner, as this me excels in self-consistency and honorable reliability. Unfortunately, Goethe's moral judgment is based on a lot of evidence, seemingly proving his point. Besides being a gifted musician and master of pantomime, the nephew is characterized, partly even by himself, as idle, stupid, crooked, lazy, greedy, loud, a coward, and a rotting soul, that is the rotting soul, a fool, a lunatic, a lazy, impudent, greedy, good for nothing. I can secure my well-being with the aid of vices, he says. He is depicted as a dangerous animal, a little savage, inclined to strangle his father and sleep with his mother. The nephew seems to be infinitely inferior to the me and bound for losing out badly. Now, the me, in turn, prides itself to be decent, to carry out my duties, to succor the unfortunate, to give helpful advice. These are quotes. There he is, the good guy, Lonnedom, the enlightened philosopher. Is it pity or condescendence that makes some of his judgments on the nephew sound rather generous or at least ambivalent? For instance, quote, the fellow is a compound of elevation and abjectness, of good sense and lunacy. The ideas of decency and depravity must be strangely scrambled in his head. Nothing resembles him less than he himself. Now, this is obviously the consistency issue that comes up here. And this allows us to connect Diderot's novel to our earlier discussions. The me is obviously upset for the very reason that the nephew lacks this consistency, that he is not identical with himself. From this it follows that the me defends and represents integrity as consistency. The me literally blames the nephew for not having this, and that's the English translation, admirable integrity, or in French, cette estimable unité de caractère. It has been said that the me is characterized as a principled moralist and the nephew as a Proteus. Even though the credentials seem to be divided unevenly between the two, their encounter is anything but a one-sided bashing of the nephew. The dialogue between the me and the nephew is a duel fought with razor-sharp words. The obvious, not at all rhetorical question is, who leaves the stage as a winner? Let me try to reconstruct this duel a little more systematically. Now, the me obviously takes issue with this casual indifference of the nephew and defends consistency based on, as he says, general principles of morals. The nephew replies by stating that, quote, it is with universal morality just as with universal grammar. There are exceptions, end of quote. He calls these exceptions idioms, or in French, idiotisme. And even though this doesn't look very compelling, he actually defends such idiotism. As you know, idios literally means singular, private, peculiar. So after the integrity of character, just quoted, we observe another word coming on stage again that is familiar to us from our discussion of Goethe's peculiarity, this Eigenheit. The me defends the unity of character linked to integrity as consistency. The nephew sticks to peculiarity, which in our earlier discussion was linked to integrity as intactness. The nephew's most fundamental objection to general principles is based on the claim that there be a basic non-identity between the universal and the individual. A lengthy quote, virtue is praised, but hated. People run away from it, for it is ice cold. Devout people are harsh, disagreeable, unsociable. Maybe this was your comment about earlier. I must be gay, easy, jolly, droll, entertaining. Virtue requires respect, and respect is inconvenient. Virtue is bound to be admired, and admiration is no fun. I deal with people who are bored, and I have to make them laugh. Now, what is laughable is absurdity and folly. I must consequently be absurd and a fool, end of quote. In his attempt to escape the straitjacket of morality, the nephew ends up with absurdity. He regards the discipline required by virtue as a threat. Sigmund Freud and Norbert Elias could have named Rameau's nephew as a harbinger when talking about self-restraint and its discontents. Individual consistency is complete if an individual agrees upon rules and acts based on these rules. This task is difficult or even unfeasible if the individual lives in a society that still has any bad laws, as Diderot says. In this case, you would have to hide your true convictions in order to not expose yourself to denunciation. Consistency in the strict sense is to be revoked if one has to practice dissimulation in order to survive. They also discuss Socrates here. The me and the nephew actually agrees on the fact that role play, or as they call it, taking positions, is omnipresent in the society of the day. The crowd is used to pretense, mimicry, and adaptation. The nephew practices it extensively. The me condemns it. How do we evade the inconsistency of role play, the inauthenticity of taking positions? The me is inclined to take a step back and to lead a life disentangled from compromising involvements altogether. I quote, there is one human being who is exempted from this pantomime. That is the philosopher who has nothing and asks for nothing. Diogenes serves as an example. This solution turns out to be self-defeating, unfortunately. He really loses his argument, and the nephew is on the upswing. The nephew doubts that such autarky and self-sufficiency is at all feasible or that it is in any way morally valuable. It is questionable why a subject excelling in more integrity should be fond of escapism and isolation. Maintaining consistency in isolation is impossible. Now, where does that leave us? While seeking to maximize consistency, the serious self-contained me runs into problems, while the disillusioned nephew excels in role-playing in a multiplication of identities. To his audience, he is said to be worth a whole lunatic asylum. Being a madhouse, basically. Being an actor and a player is always good for a surprise, and a nephew is not eager to force consistency upon others either. Now let's look at his description of his relation to others, because one of the debates between the nephew and the me circles around education. And at this occasion, the nephew rejects education, which connects to Goethe's formation, as a means for stuffing grand maxims into his son's head. He remains skeptical as to whether these maxims resonate with the gifts of a particular young man. To be sure, after adopting such maxims, this youngster would function as required. He would belong to a bunch of people representing the same type, espèce in French, art in German. So this is the second round of this discussion of art, or the type, the danger of being ridden by a type, the title of my talk. According to the nephew, this homogeneity or conformity is, of all descriptions, the worst, because it indicates mediocrity. That was a quote. The nephew prefers his son to be unique, and he himself prefers to be unique as well. My type, he says, is rare. Yes, very rare. Basically contending that this type exists in one exemplar only. The nephew's dismissal of moral maxims sound rather complacent. Isn't it mandatory when it comes to morals to create a certain conformism, or to use Diderot's word, to belong to an espèce or type? What's so bad or mediocre about a type? This becomes conceivable when we turn to the nephew's own idea of education. Neither virtues nor vices he wants to teach his son. Quote, no. What is more difficult is to teach him the right measure, the art to avert disgrace, dishonor, and the laws. There are dissonances in the harmony of society which one must know how to use, prepare, and salvage. Nothing is duller than a progression of common chords. One wants something which stings, breaks up the clear white light of like a prism, and makes it iridescent. End of quote. Before having a short look at this passage, let me add how the me reacts to this statement. And the me says, quote, very good. Your comparison brings me back from morals to music, the chords. I prefer you as a musician rather than as a moralist. Then the nephew returns, and yet I'm only second rate in music, whereas I'm a superior moralist. And the me sticks to his guns and says, I doubt this, but even if it were so, I am an honest man, and your principles do not suit me. End of quote. So the me takes the nephew's comment on deviation and dissonance as a purely aesthetic statement, which it is not. The nephew's message is as aesthetic as it is moral. In a more general tune, we can summarize this message as follows. Education, or to allude to the German Bildung, formation, is not about memorizing moral principles, nor is it about maximizing benefits with the little help of viciousness. The moral and aesthetic place to be is a place in between, a place at the margins. It is from this point only that you can begin to form judgments, uncover commonplaces as prejudices, and leave the fixed life form of a given type unhinged. This type shows up all over the place in the novel. Why do I find the figure of the nephew compelling in the context of a discussion of integrity? He is a complete failure when it comes to consistency, for two fairly different reasons. One bad, one good. First, consistency is out of reach for him, as his strategy of survival, game plan, mode of operation, is surrendering to others completely, being to others' liking by acting as a fabricant of impressions. Yet the nephew doesn't just settle for adaptation and dependency in order to survive. Secondly, he turns the tables and outperforms or overcomes his own submissive game plan. He does not just play in order to please others. By playing, he acts out of the ordinary. He raises above a free, prefabricated life, functioning comme il faut. This positive mode of creative role-playing can be regarded as a surprising variant of integrity as intactness. Paradoxically speaking, the nephew defends his intactness by dissolving his identity. What does that mean? He resists the danger of being ridden by a type. This, by the way, is a line from Henry James. I love it. The danger of being ridden by a type. He resists this danger and rebuts the absorption by a world where everything works as a matter of course, where everybody is bored and insists on knowing what they are doing. The liberating mode of role-playing fulfills a critical function indeed, and this is crucial, this critical function of his resistance as integrity, defending his intactness. He challenges the complacency of those who know it alls, who have settled down and skipped self-scrutiny. I mentioned earlier that the attitude of the me towards the nephew is not just dismissive, but deeply ambivalent. In fact, at times it is supportive. Here is the strongest expression of support for this supposedly rotting soul, where the me acknowledges the critical function of the nephew's eccentricity. The nephew is said to, and that's my favorite passage from the novel, is said to stand out from the rest and break that tedious uniformity, which our education, our social conventions, and our customary good manners have brought about. If such a character makes his appearance, like the nephew, in some circle, he is like a grain of yeast that ferments and restores to each of us a part of his native individuality. He shakes and stirs us up, end of quote. The nephew turns out to be a relative of the genius who at other occasions is praised for breaking new ground by Diderot. So Diderot's own sympathies may go back and forth between the me and the nephew. He certainly does not plainly identify with the me. Lengthy debate in the literature. Last short section, noble depravity. Few clashes between great minds are as fast and furious as this clash between two readers of Diderot's, Goethe and Hegel. As mentioned earlier, Goethe's translation appears in 1805, and so do his notes where he takes sides with the me and dismisses the nephew as a scoundrel. 2 years later, in 1807, Hegel publishes a book, as you well know, in which a place of honor is reserved for this very nephew, this the phenomenology of the spirit. Neither Diderot's nor Rameau's name is mentioned in the book as a source, but several quite long key passages from the novel are cited and actually marked as quotations, anonymous quotations. Hegel clearly takes sides with the nephew and dismisses the me. How very unlikely is this homage to the little savage, the rotting soul? What a weird friend Hegel has picked. A minute ago, I mentioned that the nephew turns against the notion of type or espèce. Now, Hegel picks up this critique. He actually uses the French word espèce, three times in the Phenomenology, and quotes the nephew's verdict that espèce is the most horrible of all nicknames, for it means mediocrity and expresses the highest level of contempt. The Phenomenology of the Spirit is about a self that finds itself in a process of development, formation, or Bildung. During this process, it comes across and lives through various crises, dead ends, new beginnings. Hegel describes them vividly. Special self, suspiciously monitored by Hegel, is a self slowing down this process. A self concerned with and confined to, as he says, the specific particularity of a given nature. It is not to his liking to stick to such particularity as one's sole purpose and content. Hegel criticizes the reduction of personal development to a given way of life, to espèce, or habit. His notion of formation or Bildung is fairly ambitious. In order to live up to Hegel's expectations, you are to expose yourself to the abundant possibilities offered by the world. The complacent self gets stuck within itself. Hegel questions alleged wisdom. He volunteers to dismiss and to deride those who are full of themselves and think they know who they are. They don't. They are caught in a cage of assumed supremacy. Their domain is no bigger than their own backyard, as they lack the precious ability to get lost in the world, an ability in which the nephew, who is said at times completely lose his head, excels. According to Hegel, nobility is the paramount condition of a saturated mind constricted to the affirmation and defense of a given rank, status, privilege, estate, etc. The supposedly noble consciousness, I quote from Hegel, turns out to be equally as base and depraved as the depravity. He seeks to turn the tables, Hegel, to retrieve a sense of nobility that emerges and even benefits from deprivation. Verwerfung is the German word. Verworfenheit. The moral judgment is inverted. Even the self-assured moral superiority of the me is deemed to be complacent. In Hegel, the decline of nobility is dialectically complemented by the rise of a depraved subject that transforms itself, I quote, into the nobility of the most culturally matured freedom of self-consciousness. This rising star is the nephew. He's the ultimate counterpart to what is called type in Hegel. Hegel embraces the idea of overcoming standardization, conformism, branding. The nephew escapes typecasting by indulging in infinite transgressions, by cultivating what Diderot calls the alienation of the spirit, aliénation de l'esprit. Hegel faithfully adopts this phrase and brings it to fame. Alienation, Entfremdung, becomes one of the key terms of 19th and 20th century social philosophy and criticism. In fact, Hegel's alienation is not to be complained about. It is a precious achievement, envisaged by Hegel as an antidote to the fixed mindset, espèce, of the me. It is rather daring a move to emphatically take the nephew's side and claim that his attitude, the absolute and universal inversion and alienation, quote, is nothing but pure cultural development, you heard that. By driving this point home, Hegel does not just disagree with Goethe's moral depreciation of the nephew. He attacks Goethe on his home turf, on the field of formation, on the field of self-formation of Bildung. For Hegel, Bildung and the self-alienation of the spirit are one and the same. Self-alienation, he says, paves the way to a more comprehensive notion of self-consciousness. It is meant to be an exposure to things alien to the subject, an attempt to throw yourself into a world that is unknown and to transcend self-content. Hegel's appreciation of the nephew is certainly fostered by the fact that the latter never seeks to turn his role-playing into a self-sufficient illusion. By his honesty, or as Hegel puts it, by stating the deceit, the movement of the character, or in Hegel's word, the formation of self-consciousness, becomes transparent. The nephew is as enraptured in his musical orgy as he is unequivocal about the fact that his frenzy, is superficial, lacks seriousness, that it is a passing condition. The nephew's may be a damaged life, yet he stands out as an intransigent representative of critique, as someone who has gained distance to common sense, not by climbing up to the high seat of pure neutralized theory, but by defending his voice. To be sure, the critical consciousness of the nephew, his raid against the type, is just an intermediary step on the long journey described by Hegel, a journey eventually leading to the praise of totality, of integrity as consistency, and pushing for the reconciliation of the individual and the universal. But maybe Hegel's final philosophical goal is less convincing than he thought it was, less viable and livable than the positions assumed on the way. Among them, first and foremost, the nephew's critical stance, his experience of alienation, and his opposition to common sense and typification. Half a minute left. To sum up, Integrity as consistency cannot be limited to personal life. Any such consistency is deemed to remain defective as long as the synchronization, the harmony between self-identity and collective identity, is missing. That is, this kind of integrity is not available in hard times, in times when conflicts between the individual and the universal prevail. Now, there aren't any times that aren't hard times in this sense. Thank you for laughing. Integrity as consistency is always in the making and never complete. Maybe project, perspective, vision come into play here. We heard about that. What is in reach for us humans is integrity as intactness, a self-defense of the individual, not aiming at idiosyncrasy, autarky, supremacy, or complacency, but at gaining a critical stance and putting the society to the test. This is where we come to agree with the vision put forward by the me, as well as by the nephew in Diderot's novel, a vision shared by Hegel and many others, the vision of a life, that's from Diderot, apart from servitude, indépendante de la servitude. Merci.